You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 25th of February to the 2nd of March 2016. My name is John Elms and I'm joined today by features editor Paul Jump and reporters Ellie Bothwell and Chris Havergal. And on our pages this week, the remuneration of university leaders is on the agenda yet again, as exit packages for outgoing vice-chancellors have been deemed particularly concerning. Chris Havergal has been poring over various universities' accounts and will give us a full update in just a while. There have been many stories of the academic response to the refugee crisis, the ongoing refugee crisis, but one scholar has taken a hands-on approach and set up a school to allow Syrian refugees access to education. Ellie has been talking to her about her experiences. And Paul will be giving us a roundup of our feature section. This week we have discussions around the funding model for research in UK universities and whether or not academics are making most of their oratorical skills. Chris, though, you've been dredging some more data on vice-chancellor's pay.
Yes, you're right to say it's that time of year when vice-chancellor's pay is very much in the public eye. That's because universities are all publishing their accounts at this time of year. What this does is not just look, it's not looking at university pay across the board. This is in particular looking at payments made to vice-chancellors who leave their universities, often in what you could describe as perhaps controversial circumstances or indeed just very suddenly. We've already covered previously in the magazine some of the payments for loss of office that were made to Wendy Purcell at Plymouth when she moved from vice-chancellor to president. The article in this week's magazine makes very clear that that was by no means the only case of its type in 2014-15. Take the example of the University of Salford. Martin Hall relinquished his line management duties in December 2014, went on sabbatical the following month, and eventually retired in June that year. For that year, his salary was pretty much the same as the previous year. Fair enough, you might say, but then actually looking at what additional payments were made to him, the accounts reveal that he was paid £110,000 in compensation for loss of office, including having his legal fees paid, and also £30,000 covering his relocation costs to South Africa. Glyndwr University in Wales is another example where Michael Scott, who departed there rather suddenly as well in January 2015, received a significant pay rise up to £300,000. Or about sort of about 33% year on year. I should say around Martin Hall, actually the percentage increase there is much bigger. His total pay went up to £394,000, or 56%. So there's some large sums of money there. I mean, what I should say is that the universities would say that these are sums which were either in accordance with vice-chancellor's contracts or were agreed with the vice-chancellors on their departure. Glyndwr says that a remuneration committee had been well informed about institutional and personal issues which might be relevant. However, at a time when the overall level of pay for vice-chancellors is very much being hotly debated, Sally Hunt, the General Secretary of the University and College Union, says that these large payoffs for those who, in her words, whose leadership has been called into question, she says is particularly concerning.
Absolutely. And I mean, we could always speculate about why these payments are going out. Did you speak to anyone about what reasons there might be?
Yeah, I spoke to Michael Shattuck, who's a visiting professor at UCL Institute of Education, who's been looking at university governance for many decades. Speaking generally, not about these specific cases, he describes golden goodbyes, as he calls them, as an inducement to persuade someone to leave who you think may be reluctant to do so. Clearly that could be the case in the case of some vice-chancellors. But it goes both ways, he says. It's not just about the vice-chancellors getting large sums of money. He does point out that in a lot of universities, There may not be a sort of rigorous or regular appraisal system with vice-chancellors. So perhaps when the chair of the board raises concerns, or indeed a new chair of the board is appointed, that may be the first time that these concerns are being raised with the vice-chancellor. So Michael Shattuck says that, you know, in some of these cases, the vice-chancellors may be involved in, it could well be that vice-chancellors have, in his words, good arguments to fight being forced out.
Absolutely, absolutely. As Chris mentioned earlier, VC pay and the salaries of our university leaders is often hotly debated. I'm not going to speak any more about that situation for fear of saying anything controversial. But yes, a matter that will continue to fill the column inches whenever there is data to be had, I imagine. A different tack, Ellie, your piece in this week's, one of your pieces in this week, I should say, is it's a particularly poignant account. You've heard, spoken to an academic who set up a refugee school, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So it's a lecturer at Brighton, Julie Pratton, and the story sort of just shows kind of the ways in which, the various ways in which universities can kind of help during the refugee crisis, and also kind of the way in which kind of advance in technology mean, you know, it's so much easier now than it would have been sort of a few decades ago. So she, Julie, was talking on a Facebook group with other teachers about how she could assist in the Syrian refugee crisis. Someone who was a logistics officer at a camp in Iraqi Kurdistan saw the post and kind of said, oh, you know, we'd really like you to help. Us and someone else sent her a message from McGill University in Canada, and they'd set up a GROOC, which is kind of like a MOOC, but it's centred on group learning,
right.
And it was basically it was quite a kind of wide topic. The GROOC, they could kind of basically do whatever they wanted, but one of the groups on there was looking at helping Syrian children. So Julie sort of joined this group. She ended up being team leader, and their aim was to sort of set up this school in the camp that the logistics officer was working in, and then they got permission to turn an old sort of unit into a classroom, and they got volunteers from nearby, and they've hired a teacher who's volunteering there now. She just sort of described about how the children were just sort of queuing up to get in. A lot of the help at camps has been focused on kind of health and medical care,
but
obviously, so many children who, frankly, they're just kind of on their own for a lot of the day. They don't, have anything to do. They don't have anything to sort of stimulate their mind. And she's kind of hoping that she can set up more of these schools, and that actually, if she can get internet access, then maybe some adults can also learn there. So it's quite an inspiring example.
Sure. And you also cover not directly in the main piece, but it's your piece is one example of how academics are helping. But your other piece, a little box that you've written at the bottom, is commenting on, well, you've got someone to comment on how academics are well placed to help refugees, and in what sense are they?
So it was Queen Mary University in London held a sort of refugees welcome program, a week long, and they held open days where refugees and their families could just pop in, and they'd get free legal advice and free sort of education advice. And then there were also a lecture and a film screening. The sort of professor who launched that basically just said, universities are sort of well placed to help in this crisis. There should be more of this. Certainly, I'm sure a lot of universities could easily hold open days. I mean, Queen Mary is particularly well placed because their law department has a specific sort of programme for immigration law.
Right.
And so there are experts there who can sort of advise refugees on that.
I mean, it's quite an interesting contrast between the two pieces, actually, because I think a lot of the universities are trying to work out, they probably want to do something about Syria and the refugee crisis. They're trying to work out actually how to do it. You've got two approaches here. One, which is to set up on the ground in the region, which could have a big impact, but can be expensive, can be pretty difficult to do.
Mm.
And then on the other hand, you've got delivering things in the UK for refugees who get here, But then there's the question of, well, you know, it's all very well, you know, offering scholarships, offering courses, but it's so hard for refugees to actually get to the UK in the first place. Are you actually having the impact? Are these really the people in most need? So it's interesting. I'm sure, you know, universities will continue trying to work out which approach is best, probably without getting a final answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue, you know, both are needed.
Yeah.
And they're sort of both valid. I mean, in terms of the sort of cost of the school, Julie actually only raised about £2,000, she said, and she hasn't actually used it all already. So it's not sort of massive sums of money.
Yeah.
Just for quite a basic school.
Of course, absolutely. And as pointed out, not a lot of vast sums, but clearly changing a lot of people's lives on the small level or greater level. Ellie's story is on page 16. I thoroughly recommend having a look at it and reading it in full. Paul, you're going to take us through our feature section and what have you been finding out? We've got a couple of very different pieces.
We have, yeah. The first one is, yes, quite a heavy duty look at the way research funding is currently distributed in Britain. It's written by three people from Lancaster University, including the VC, Marquis Smith, and it draws on a lot of data to make the point, which isn't a new one but is still quite a controversial one, that essentially that there are too many universities competing for research funding at the current time, given the expansion of the sector and the expansion in the number of academics. So they look, for example, at the amount of QR per FTE, QR being obviously quality related research funding, per academic sort of pre and post REF, and you know there's quite a few very prominent universities such as Imperial, Oxford and Cambridge which have lost ground on that in post REF, despite the fact that they did very well in the REF. And the reason for that is because the post 92s, for them it's quite easy to have a large percentage increase in QR. Again, the stats on that some of them have sort of 300-500% rises in the amount of QR they get, whereas most pre-92s are sort of stuck around zero, basically, around no change. And obviously, they also make the point that, you know, this imposes a lot of pressure within universities. A lot of the the accountability for finances is sort of passed down from the government to universities to departments. And they make the point that that's where the managerialism that everybody complains about, that's where that arises. That's why that arises, because the departments themselves ultimately bear the burden. Has the further consequence that interdisciplinary research is difficult to organise because every department's looking after its own back, basically. So there are a lot of problems. I mean, they basically call on the government, industry and the sectors to sort of get their heads together to sort this out. Sure. I mean, they say the government needs to support a goal-orientated layering of the landscape, which is obviously a bit jargony, but essentially sounds like something like the California system, where certain universities are designated research universities and are eligible to apply for funding and others aren't. Obviously, that's a very controversial suggestion. Funnily enough, we have a piece about the California system coming up in a couple of weeks. So whether that could take off in the UK, who knows? But certainly they make the point that something needs to change, otherwise certain universities are going to go out of business. And you know, obviously quality research ultimately will suffer.
Absolutely.
Shall we move on to the other one?
Yeah,
a very different piece about academic voice, and by this written by Joe Moran at Liverpool John Moores. And by voice, he doesn't mean voice in the metaphorical sense of the student voice or anything like that. He is talking literally about voices. And he makes the point that this is something that's actually very neglected by universities, that, you know, sort of being citadels of the mind, that the sort of physical aspects of voice are very neglected. But obviously, if you're a lecturer, you know, the way you use your voice is potentially rather important. And he advocates things like reading books aimed at actors primarily, for training their voices. He suggests that in universities the most convivial acoustics are in stairwells and toilets. which may well be metaphorically significant, but obviously also to do with the fact that all the surfaces are hard there. I don't know if you made all the chairs in lecture theatres hard, you probably have similar acoustics, but whether the students would appreciate that, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it also makes the point that getting students to speak is very useful in terms of getting them to understand what they're reading. He thinks that that has an effect on that. And it also has an effect on improving their writing. He suggests that, you know, bad writing is partly a consequence of having a tin ear for a good sentence, basically. And that, you know, good speakers, good orators tend not to have that tin ear. And, you know, the suggestion is that the more students are required to speak in lectures and seminars, you know, the more their writing is likely to improve. Again, how realistic that is, I don't know, but that's the suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, has he based that on his own students' experiences? I mean,
if he doesn't say that explicitly. He does. I mean, he does talk about his own experience as a lecturer in terms of improving his own voice and failing at times to do it. He still has shallow breathing, dropped consonants and falling inflection, he confesses at one point. But you can certainly see his point. I mean, it is true. Yeah. That he makes the rather startling observation on the Higher Education Academy's website. If you type in keyword voice, you get more than 1,000 hits, but absolutely none of those relate to voice in a literal sense. It's all, you know, the student voice and stuff like that. So, I mean, it certainly is a neglected topic.
Absolutely. As I say, two wildly different pieces, both very, very interesting in their own right. And that feature section begins on page 34, I believe. Yes, 34 in our magazine. We've run out of time for our issue review podcast this week, but I would like to just flag up our splash by John Morgan, who is away this week. He has written a story which suggests that the government is set to introduce a higher education bill, possibly following a white paper in May, because as part of the reason David Cameron is said to be convinced by the need for legislation. At the same time, there have been concerns raised over Hefke plans put out to tender a quality assurance. John Splash covers both of those important matters on pages 6 and 7, and I thoroughly recommend you read it. But as I say, we've run out of time, but we value your input and any of the matters discussed. You can comment on them using all manner of social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course our website. Please check out the rest of the magazine online and in print. There are lots more stories that you can read. But until next week, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.